Yeah.
There's an aspect, non-triviality is delightful.
I mean, that's why steampunk is so, so phenomenal and interesting, is because it's about not being able to rely on your machines and having them be questionable if they're going to work or not.
I know a lot of this is really hitting home because I spend all day in a corporate job where everybody is a trivial part of a machine, and I just...
Managing triviality is a complex
I don't know if I've mentioned this before, but I was trying to explain recently to a 13-year-old girl what it was to be in this job, and it was exactly about toasters. It was... It's like... Yeah, she wanted to know specifically... Part of my job involves riding an elevator for large portions of my day, and occasionally I sing very loudly in the elevator, and at one point the security guard commented because he could see me singing. And anyway. She wanted to know, well, why can't you sing? And I said, well, okay, you have a toaster. You expect it to make toast, and you go about your day, and every day it makes you toast, and it does what you want, and then all of a sudden you go over it, and your toaster's singing. There's a low level of irritation that it seems like a lot of people have these days towards triviality that has nothing to do with function or dysfunction. It's as orthogonal to it as a toaster singing, and yet it bothers us because we're so busy trying to manage this amount of complexity that we have just these very low tolerances for extra complexity. And I think that's a big factor.
That's how, I mean, so much of our education in industrial and corporate society came from. The Industrial Revolution was all about trivializing people to manage complexity. We created the assembly line. We said, okay, you're going to do this, you're going to do this, you're going to do this, and together we're going to make a complex machine. We're going to make a complex organism. And then we developed management and organizational science for that, first half of the 20th century. And
so then we're also getting better, and this hopefully will tie into the phone conversation we're having. By the way, hi, Jonathan. How's it going? Tie into the phone stuff where I trivialize conversations all the time because they're in chat logs, and I don't have to give all my attention to it at once. I can, okay, this is over in this thing, and this is over here, and this is over here, and I can address it when I need to, and either it updates or it doesn't. And I get to figure out how I want to respond to it. And honestly, I think it's kind of caused my social attention span to dwindle. And I've always kind of flitted around in social situations anyway, where I'll talk to one person, and it's how I ran a club night and made it tight-knit, where I would talk to one person, and someone else would come up and want to talk to me, and be, oh, hey, how's it going? Here's this person. You two should talk. I'm going to go do this other thing. And so people got to know each other, but at the same time, I don't have to hold an entire conversation at once. I can do it over time. And I think that's changing how I relate to people when they're actually in front of me and I have to talk about how their job's doing and their family and school and everything else. And, you know, it's a half hour or more conversation at once, and it kind of gets stir crazy every once in a while.
So are we looking at building up of walls between social interactions? Like, if we're talking about the real doll as trivializing sex, as making it something that's intensely individualistic, alongside with, you know, working in a place that, you're on your own doing these sort of assembly line type thing, types of jobs. And we're seeing, you know, since the Industrial Revolution, the advent of, you know, modern technology as we see it, minimalization of family-owned business, father passing down son, and people being intensely proud of what they do as artisans and as, you know, a member of a community. And is that all just going up into smoke when we come into 2010s?
I think what we do as a day job becomes less and less important, and what we do in our off time becomes more and more important.
I mean, if we're spending time, isolated on our computer or with our real dollar with the Sims, and chatting, having a little flip conversation in the Gmail window, and that's pretty much the extent of that, and your Twitter, your Facebooking, and your whatever else. You know, there's your social interactions out the window. Throw in a sex doll in that, and you don't really need to leave.
I'm not sure that I agree. I want to make a couple points here, kind of building off of the discussion you had and the point that you just made. First of all, saying that it feels to me like there's a difference between interaction with an object, like interaction with a sex doll, versus interaction that's enabled by an object. And what if your sex doll were enabled with Google Chat and Twitter?
And some people want their sex doll.
Right,
yeah.
But I mean, at that point, what if it were a very social activity, your interactions with it, if it were connected online and you had 20 friends who were commenting on your interaction with your real doll and what was happening with it?
Or not even that, but if you and your lover have very separate schedules and you each have a real doll that looks like your lover,
sure.
And they're synced so that when the person you're sleeping with is across the globe, you're both boning your real dolls that look like the other person at the same time, and you're hooked up so you can actually, you know, hear them.
Or at least
and
checking in via chat.
Yeah, checking
right.
in, and
oh,
and so
going
then
well.
Is it, so then are you interacting with the object, or are you interacting through the object?
And is your interaction then with real people, and are your real interactions and your meaningful interactions increasing or decreasing based on the use of those tools?
Well, if you're sitting looking at a computer screen, it doesn't matter who's on the other end, real or imaginary, you're still looking at a computer screen. You're still not out there, and doing what people have been doing for 3,000 years, interacting.
Well, I think interaction through a computer media. I think that there are probably some subtleties that you miss on. The sense of touch, for example. Willow touches people all the time. That's I mean.
I'm very tactile.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That's
beautiful.
Thanks.
And that's something you miss through interaction. Over GChat or whatever.
But is that something that should just be looked up?
No, but I don't think that makes GChat an unhealthy thing though.
Not at all.
Sure.
I think that there's a difference between having a GChat conversation with somebody on the other end who's able to give me intelligent replies, and the sort of interaction that I get from that and the feedback that I get from that and the stimulus response that I get from that. Versus, what would be today, a computer game,
some
PC
or
something.
I think there's some context being lost in a couple of lines we go across. We were talking about new forms of communication and telecommunications, whatever, at the same time as talking about the process of industrialization, where those things don't have anything to do with each other. And it's, you look at it, a lot of those applications were mostly developed by board office workers who wanted a way to escape from the industrialization process. And so those have actually come about almost, a lot of that technology which is now being useful for conducting business over, it came about because somebody was like, oh, if I can do a little app here like this type of way to somebody, they won't be able to tell that I'm not going to work, it's an easy way to carry on a conversation with somebody who's not there. And it doesn't necessarily mean the impetus for the origin of IM software, but.
Well, that may have been the origin, but
people
are making money off of it.
Now that we're using it as a replacement for social interactions,
I don't think we are.
And this is where
some
I really want to.
That's the thing.
Well,
but
some people, that's enough.
But that's
I find it very
that's part of what being human is about. Is that there's a huge spectrum. No matter what era we're in, technologically or socially, we're going to have people who are going to find a reason to sit in their room and not interact with others.
Exactly.
And then we're also going to have people who use the media of the time in order to enhance interactions, like Facebook. I hate it. It's evil. But at the same time, since I finally got on carefully trying to silo and protect my data, it has done wonders for my social life. I'm constantly interacting and keeping up and maintaining relationships with my friends online that then translate into offline, in-person, tactile interactions. And that is enabled by the tool, by taking the time, oh, well, this person's in town, I'm in town, let's visit, and then it happens.
Well,
and it's a human thing, not necessarily a technology thing.
So a lot of people have made the argument that technology has improved our social interactions. through things like Facebook.
Totally has.
Okay.
As opposed to a period where, you know, I'm reading the Peloponnesian War right now. I'm reading about, you know, how it takes 3 weeks for somebody to get from the front lines of communication to, you know, back home in Athens. And
wars keep
nowadays,
going even when they're over.
It's digitally shot over a satellite, you know what I'm saying?
But
exactly. There were instances of wars ending before reinforcements could arrive. You know?
Yeah.
And it's because you can't get it out that fast.
Yeah.
And just the same with the private spectrum. You know, people would come and visit, or people still do, and communicate via letters, and it takes weeks and weeks. It's not just as instantaneous and automated as it is now.
Yeah, I think people are really getting used to instant gratification on things, and that's where stuff like instant messaging, text messaging, email, stuff like that is coming into big play. Instead of going out and real dolls, instead of having the patience to physically write a letter and send it off to somebody, or go and visit somebody, or like dating sites, going and meeting someone online to avoid actually having to go out and face rejection in person and make it a little less personal by just going on there and, oh, they didn't email me back, or whatever. So I think it's people getting used to instant gratification on things. Like with Netflix now, you can download a movie to watch instead of having to wait for it to come in the mail.
Or go down to the movie store.
Yeah, or go down to the movie store.
My, I don't know if this is relevant, one of my professors always said, the father of invention is necessity. The mother is laziness.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. There's the joke, what is it, in Primer of the best mathematician is a lazy one. The space pen, why not just use a pencil?
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Breeds adventure.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I would ask the question, though, what does this have to do with the topic?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying it's irrelevant. I just think we should bring it back.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What does this have to do with how we interact with objects? And the future that's going to,
I think we're not sure how we interact with objects. I don't think we know how much these objects affect us and other people.
One good question for that is, how much are we interacting through objects, and then how much are we directly interacting with the object itself?
Who said
that?
Yeah.
Right.
Good question.
We interact with objects in the exact same way that we interact with everything else, and that part of why we build objects the way we do is because we want to continue to be able to interact with them in the style of our choosing, which guides the design philosophy behind them. I mean, we're not going to build an object if we have to learn an entire new method of communication and behavior to interact with them.
I wouldn't build a hammer that I can have a conversation with, because it's overkill. I build a hammer that puts nails in things.
Let me kind of take this another side of this question and ask, because it feels like this is sort of being implied by a lot of this. Are we expecting that our objects are or are going to be changing human nature?
I think we're tool
the
making
gratification of society.
But does that change who we? Does that change what it means to be human in a significant way, or does it change how we use tools?
It's more cultural.
I would say it changes.
Go ahead.
I would say it changes how we come to grips with the world around us, with our environment, and you know, it's a give and take. It's a constant play. You can't change the way you interact with your environment without your environment not changing how it interacts with you to some extent.
I agree with that completely. But the whole concept of human nature is that there's some essential something that remains, you know, unchanged, even though, you know, I take this form or I take that form. I can't say much about that.
The reason I ask is because as we look to the future of our interactions with each other and with objects, that kind of feels like a key element to use as we're trying to project where we're going. It's because it's as much about us as it's about the objects. We're going to continue, we're going to get objects that will increase in complexity, we're moving more and more into the one machine and the cloud and kind of ubiquity of data that's less about how what you're accessing with as opposed to that you are just accessing it. Ubiquity of data, ubiquity of tools, ubiquity of access. I mean, across the board there, then, it's asking, is that ubiquity and it going to change these interactions in a significant way? Because without asking that, how are we going to project what kind of objects we're going to be using? What is in the future?
That touches on a thought I had a couple weeks ago, is what's going to make the cell phone obsolete? What is going to be the next major channel of communication? What's going to surpass this all?
I think wetware. When it's actually, you can have it installed in you, essentially, and it ends up being...
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, too. But what would that mean? It's even more instant than a cell phone. Cell phone's still external. What happens when it becomes internal?
When communication is at the speed of thought.
You're right, exactly.
Has anybody read the new Chuck Palahniuk book?
No.
Which one?
Rent.
Chuck Palahniuk?
Yeah.
I read the one before that.
He brings up at one point this new movie watching technology where you have to implant the base of your skull and you live the movie, you live the story, you live all that sensory experience. Oh, it's a fucking movie book. It also talks about time travel and having sex with grandpa. Anyway.
Like you do.
But...
It's the story of my life.
It's something that's clearly on the table. This whole.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think a lot of people assume that wetware is inevitable, right? But I'm curious what that will mean for society.
Yeah, I've had, just speaking from personal experience and running club nights and stuff, where I'm having a very focused conversation with Rob, and someone, and Colleen could come up to me and be like, dude, shit's hitting the fan over there. And like, just a second. Talk to her really quick, and then return to things. And just as an aside, we called it a sidebar in Indiana. I'm not sure if anyone else uses that term. But, and the Cory Doctorow talks about sub-vocalization, and they're actually developing these things where it's an aside. You're still able to concentrate on what you're concentrating on, but not as much because you're always dividing your attention. You're taking away from it for a second and then coming back to it, and that takes effort, and you lose your train of thought, and it's not one long, continuous thing where it's...
Like a mouse. Because you have to go back to...
Yeah. And even just remembering where you were at takes more effort than just continuing what you were doing. There are productivity things where... Did my computer just turn off? No, it didn't. Okay. Where if you do 3 hours of homework and it's all in one stretch, you do 3 hours of homework. But if you do the same amount of homework while you're downloading something and every once in a while you respond to a chat, it takes you like 5 hours to do that same amount of work.
So here's an idea. We were talking earlier on about the evolution of real dollars and like this ideal partner, like companion type thing. What if the next step of that is you take the whole wetware scenario and essentially you say, okay, I want to be able to do multiple things with the software, hardware, flesh body fusion, whatever, potentially inhabit different bodies. You've got kind of the ghost in the shell thing where the major takes control of the guy's hands while he's driving so that she can drive through his body by diving into his brain. I'm asking about schizophrenia, multiple personality disorders. Like, is that going to become a necessity that we deliberately culture sub-personalities of ourselves and separate them so that we essentially become
I think we're seeing the beginning of that now with the proliferation of agents that help people do things.
One of the other things which is interesting, which has been a change, is I was thinking about the speed of communication and the reputation. How previously, reputation is hugely important when it takes you 3 months to get a letter somewhere. You're not going to write a letter to someone else or to do something if you have a pretty good certainty that they're going to follow through on that, therefore their reputation is important. Reputation now becomes much more flexible and mutable. It's still important, but kind of in a different way. You can have very intense, involved relationships with people where we become very intimate with them, but it might last a very short time, and you could move on and really never see them again. You could be out of contact with them for a very long time, or you can minimal level of communication, pick up and drop in and out of other people's lives and things like that pretty readily.
You have contract friendships.
Right.
Going along the lines of schizophrenia, and if it's going to be necessary, that Gregory Rollins, who's my mentor in college, he's a fantastic, intelligent guy. One of the first conversations I had with him was about whether ADHD is really a problem, per se, or if it's an adaptation. We see so much of it now. Well, we have to divide our attention and skip from one thing to another so quickly that it's a good thing, good in quotes. You know, if that's what sort of work you're doing, you can perform much better in that environment.
It may not be good, but it might be necessary.
And it's also, it's a direct response to our environment, too, the way I
right.
see it. I've always thought it's kind of absurd to say this is a mental disorder, let's prescribe drugs. It's like, it's an adaptive response to being presented in media in the different forms that, that kids are growing up now being exposed to.
Who here has ADHD?
I was told I did throughout my entire childhood.
And I just... There's the flip side to that, which is, I don't know, for me, ADD has always manifested not just as split focus, but as I'm really good at either doing five things at once or one thing immersively. I'm pretty terrible at doing one thing with light attention to anything else that might be going on.
People often assume that ADD means that you don't have enough attention. It actually means you have too much. You give everything around you the exact same amount of importance. There's no hierarchy of attention, right? And so you can pay attention to, you know, five things all at once with the same intensity, or one thing with all your intensity. That's it. It's hard for people.
I think one thing that a lot of people have with ADD, from what I've observed, is they can't seem to lock in. I mean, I've had trouble on occasion where I can't lock in on one thing. And my brother has a severe case of ADD where he has a hard time locking into things. He'll be playing a game on his computer, he'll be having a chat on a side window, and he'll have music playing off to the side and be doing something else still, and he'll be having all these things going on, but he can't lock into one thing. I've tried to sit him down and have him just sit there and play one video game, and he's like doing that, and then he'll run over to his computer and chat. So I think with ADD, it's not so much a multitasking thing where they're dividing their attention all up, it's locking onto one thing that might be the problem with
it's,
that.
You can't voluntarily lock onto stuff. That's the thing, it's not voluntary.
It happens.
Hyperfocus happens and can't control it. And that's what the drugs are for, is to help control it.
I won't go into that. There's some strong theories on that. But
drugs or no drugs.
If that is an adaptation, though, if we're going to see more of that as a result of the sorts of interactions that we're having, I think something like you were talking about might be necessary to maintain the quality of relationships that we're used to having. Because I think that, I know from my experience, both from having ADD and from finding ways to cope with that through meditation and things like that, that there is some trade-off between breadth and depth. The more things that I'm doing, the less of my intention any one of those things can have. So, if it gets to the point that we can't remember anything because we're so used to looking it up in Google, and we can't maintain one conversation because we're used to having five at once, in order to maintain the quality of memory or conversation or whatever that we're used to having, we may have to come up with a scheme such as what you were talking about, to manage that. Or we stop, or our qualities change, our values change. We may not value those things in the same way that we have in the past.
I think that's extremely likely because, as we can see with other types of things, value changes pretty quickly in cultures, and culture changes pretty fast.
There's often also, too, though, you know, like a sense of, like I see it a lot even now, even in people of say, our generation, people now and then having like a sense of, man, stuff used to be simpler. Wasn't that cool? Or,
yeah.
Like
you know, yeah, people used to really connect. Wasn't that cool when we used to do that? Or,
mm-hmm.
or something like that.
Yeah.
Always and forever.
Back when you
always
used to be kids.
I think the good old days have always been alive.
Well, and you're quite right, but I think that may have something to do with where the heredity part of evolution comes into play, and us continuing to inherit things from the past. I don't know what of the quality of relationships that we had prior to the information explosion. I can't predict what of that we're going to inherit and what of that we're going to keep. But I think that definitely going to change some things.
Just briefly, what used to be good or what used to be bad, and we tend to think that because everyone's had good experiences and bad experiences, but I think for the most part, most of us are fairly unsure all the time why we're having a good experience or a bad experience, we tend to connect it to things which we think it might be. So if you connect something to the past, you remember having had good experiences once upon a time, well, the past must have been better because I'm not having a good time right now. Therefore, things were different then than they are now. Well, yeah, things were different then. You were having a good time, but that's not because it was then and this is now.
I think there's some of that. But, you know, I'll give you an example, though. I hate going into to buy an electronic something and being asked if I want to pay $20 more to have it warranted. Because I am of the opinion that if you're selling me something, you should back it up. It should be a quality product. I shouldn't have to pay to not have it break within 30 days.
Right.
And you know, I've talked to people who have mentioned as anecdote, and I mean I've never done a study or witnessed any studies on this, but I have mentioned people talk about how that's a very much a new phenomenon. I mean there were always sharks and marks in the world, right? But there was a time maybe when that quality was more assumed than it is now.
Yeah,
and there wasn't so much planned obsolescence in products and stuff like that. And I think that there's a sense in which somebody might get annoyed at the planned obsolescence and go, you know what? We used to do it differently. What were we doing back then?
Bringing that back into what we were talking about. What do you do when you're attached to your tech that has planned obsolescence in it? Like, I know that this is going to die forever at some point.
We'll mourn it and move on, just like a pet.
Yeah, but the thing that's different about this is that if the people who were creating this were a little bit more modular, it doesn't have to die. It can keep going. It's like Wall-E. You just replace different parts and you have the same thing.
That's the direction I think that we're going, though, because so much of the process of computing is being moved to the cloud.
Yes and no. Some things are becoming more modular and are developing an obsolescence of the product without an obsolescence of the pattern, and that's good, but not everything and not most things. Most things are getting shorter shelf lives. And
I guess my question is that the trend going to continue, or as we begin to move more into cloud-based computing where all of our applications and data are being stored somewhere out there as opposed to with us, is modularity going to become a larger component and the obsolescence of individual objects become less of a component, or are we still going to look at, we've all seen the pace of technology continuing to increase and increase and increase. There's the stuff that's in the labs right now is unbelievable.
If we want to maintain an economy, you have to have a continual throughput of materials and products. What you need to do is basically the problem with current society is it's constipated, but you can't put anything out without it becoming a problem. So you know, you need more of a rough engine on that, and you have to recycle our products better. Then it doesn't really matter if it wears out in a few days, so long as the price is something which the user, can pay for it, and it gets appropriately remanufactured at the end of the cycle. There's nothing inherently bad in having something not last very long, so long as that's planned into a sustainable cycle.
True. I think it might be the case that we have to use that type of approach for many of the things that we're thinking of, like these fabulous energy storage technologies that are supposed to be coming. I think it might be something more along a reusing line. But I'd like to make one comment about relating to machines that's a little bit more practical. It has to do with the example of the introduction of the calculator being used in education in like a mathematical setting. And why is it not acceptable to use a computer to Google something or something like that during like an academic setting? I mean,
yeah, that's
it's a totally legit question.
It is, but we should talk about it after the meeting.
Okay.
That's a fantastic tangent. It was one of the first meetings we had, sort of, that Colleen came up with the idea for information diets and consuming your information responsibly.
I can make this relate back to talking about how we relate to our technology and machines, though, which is that basically, I mean, where does your mind end? Why do you assume your mind stops at your skull?
That's what I'm saying.
So part of our relationship with technology is that it is, I mean, it's already, the only thing which isn't a web interface is that we don't actually plug it into our head, but to all intents and purposes, we interact with it in the same way. That's what I was saying earlier on about, I think the way we interact with our machines is like the way we interact with everything else, because we interact with things in a human way.
And it's like making a list of things to remember, right? You're
right.
You can't store enough of it in here, so you put it external, right? Well, why can't that list be the size of the internet?
Right. Well, I think that technology's job is by and large to amplify our abilities. So, to say that it's ethically sound to use a hammer to nail things that your skin isn't physically strong enough to pound in, but it's unethical to use a calculator to do math calculations when you can't keep track of it in your head. I think there's a disconnect there. But I do see the value in learning to do some things the hard way. But I think that might be one way to look at this is, as far as interactivity with objects, is looking at objects that amplify our abilities, our behaviors. Lights amplify our ability to see. Tables amplify, things. In a kind of an abstract way, they amplify our range, right? That I have to bend over and pick it up on the floor. It's right here.
Can I?
Go ahead.
When you're done.
Oh, go ahead. if you can make something useful of that land, please do.
I was thinking about that, and I was thinking about from... as a craftsperson with a toolbox, when I put an item into my toolbox, I think of it, that is a part of my body, and I am making a pact with myself that I am not going to be able to do certain things without that tool. And it is a consideration, because if I'm going to incorporate a calculator, I'm making a pact with myself that I will not be able to do math without a calculator. And that's not good or bad, it's just, if you think of the perimeter of your body as not being your body, it's a different form of responsibility. And it's not quite the same as the information diet, it's more medium than information, but...
I wouldn't say you're making a pact with yourself that you can't do it without it, but that you can't do it as well.
Right, right. But I mean, it's certainly, it's definitely a form of incorporation.
It's lazy.
But are you saying that you make...
It's prioritization.
That you make a conscious compromise? Like in the case of the calculator, you make a conscious compromise to I'm going to trade not learning all these math formulae for the ability to quickly do math on a calculator?
I do? That doesn't mean that I...
I don't know that everybody does. I
forgot basic math when I started doing calculus. I think a lot of people go through that.
It's something that I think about entirely too much. So...
Going... Sorry. interject one second. I don't think it's laziness necessarily. I think it's efficiency.
Mm-hmm. I think
and prioritization.
About the quality of the tools we're using. A good tool is something which is going to be designed with ergonomics in mind. So a good hammer is going to be a hammer which, when you use it, it, like you were saying, it amplifies your capabilities. You don't want to have a hammer which it will drive in nails really good, but it actively hampers your ability to use your arms for other tasks. So it's possible that a lot of the technology we have may, in some way, you know, could you make a calculator which would not only be really good at doing calculations for you, but would, by using it, enhance your ability to use math? Yes, you can. It's called an abacus, and it works really well.
Can a calculator do the same thing?
No, but you said an abacus.
I know, but can't a calculator enhance your ability to do math?
I don't think the ones we have do that terribly well.
It obscures the process.
It obscures the process, whereas an abacus,
right.
you'll get people who train on abacuses, and then they have a mental abacus, and they might be amazing math judgment because they can see that working. So
when I wasn't thinking addition and division, I was thinking
you can
complex functions.
You can do more than that on an abacus, but for complex functions, then the question is, can you design the tool in such a way that it improves your ability to do complex functions.
It's a brilliant question design.
Yeah, and if you think about the question as a black box issue, then you're comparing, even in a tool use, the difference between using a hammer and using a stapler, right? And it does it for me. And because using, I found that using a lot of machine tools would make me, didn't actually increase my skill set at all. But using tools where it was an extension of my hand, I became incredibly accurate regardless of what tool I was using, just as a function of having to focus and pinpoint and sort of feel through my hand what was happening.
It's like the difference between using a multi-gym and using freeways.
Yes, exactly.
You guys know that they found people who play a lot of first-person shooters are better at recognizing things instantly, right?
Yeah.
Or like seeing, picking out things far away.
You made a point few minutes ago that I want to highlight, because you called it a rant, but you said the tech's job is to amplify our abilities and behaviors, and I think that that is...
Well, or to attenuate something in the environment.
I think that's a good argument for making the distinction between the function of, say, a real doll and
an abacus.
Because one of them is sort of a dead-end amplification, and the other one is...
Well, I would definitely say that in the case of a real doll, its utility is not obvious, right? You know,
right.
I mean, well, in a sense it is.
A gigolo for paraplegics,
right.
I'm sorry to get really crude, but then it could have some utility.
Right.
Or, I mean, as a practice device for someone who's really shy and wants to try out their technique and, you know, with lower risk.
Sure.
I think that was one of the arguments in Sex and Love with Robots, wasn't it? Like sex practice robots?
Yeah, I mean,
the robot would be able to give you that feedback, a real doll,
right.
Sit there and laser.
Right.
Laser.
What if you made one that could give you feedback?
I just want to add to that the same distinction occurs between people. When we put people in an assembly line, we're quite clearly making them amplifiers of our own abilities. When you tell somebody we love them, it's a very different operation. Now there may be some common ground. I won't claim any certainty as to where that is. But
this is where the future gets really interesting. Once we combine that idea with the discussion of when wetware shows up, when or if, because then the notion of amplification. Takes on a whole different set of meanings, because at that point we're having the tools to be amplifying each other's abilities
and in
the same way, but
right
at faster speed.
And the two work hand in hand, you know, like we were talking about with GChat, for example.
Mm-hmm.
You know, instant messaging is an amplification utility. You know, but at the same time, what we're communicating through that medium can be quite difficult to reduce to something so utilitarian.
Mm-hmm.
Especially on the medium producing what we're communicating.
The other thing which is hard to spot but important to remember is out there is synergistic effects. A good example being you have a teleconference going on and everyone's just on the phone line, it's very, very hard to communicate. If yeah, if I am going to, then you can have a meta conversation about the main conversation going, which you can then utilize to control who's speaking when over your voice line.
In that same line, though, a calculator and computer can improve your understanding of math, because what do you want to know for certain what the irrational form of pi is? You're not going to, I mean, you can have thousands of people all adding a certain part of it, but a computer allows you to program, you can, once you can program it to do the math, and when you spend time programming, and with a TI calculator with complex functions, you have to program it to do that type of stuff. You become, I've become more familiar, and then you can know what the irrational number of pi is out to the billionth digit or whatever.
I was going to bring that example up, actually, just really quickly. I have found that learning how electronic calculators work has definitely assisted my ability to program and to program math functions and how computers work in general. So I think that there's some of that.
You just have to explore it. And
I think I have a really good example of this discussion. When I was doing my last quarter of calculus, first year calculus, we had a huge final. It had no deadline. It was like, it took me 8 hours. Some people took longer. So unlimited time, but we all sat in class. And yeah, it was crazy having the same teacher. Anyway, so I was going through it, solving this problem, and doing this huge integral and whatever. And I'd go along, punch in my calculator, go back, you know, back and forth, like a simple arithmetic calculator. It's like a TI 30X, great calculator. But it doesn't do any graph functions, any calculus or anything. Like the TI-89 does. But anyway, I punch into it, 3 + 4.
Right.
And like back and forth, like, and then I went back and forth. Why did I do that? You know, why would I should be able to do that in my head.
Well,
but you become dependent on it. You like go, well, I know I'm not very reliable, but this is, so I'll just use this.
For me though, I'm very dyslexic, but I'm also very good at math theory. I understand how math is supposed to work, but if I'm the one writing down the numbers, I will mess it up. Like, just period. It will be a huge jumble of numbers that weren't even there in the first place, sort of thing. But I TA'd a statistics class for sociology because I understand it, and I could do Excel spreadsheets that would even do the simple functions because I'm good at the theory part, which is where I think pulling from Google, it's getting you the facts, it's getting you the 3 + 4 without the human error. But then you can talk about, well, what does the 3 + 4 mean? How is that pulling into this entirety of the theory?
Yeah.
Well, see, that's the thing is, you know, would I have been able to do that on the fly while solving this complex problem? And see, that's why people make the argument that Google's making this stupid, is because if you, by depending on this thing, become less capable doing it yourself.
Well, you just really forget what 3 + 4 equals. You
right.
just developed a habit.
And it's a good thing. Presumably, you had other things going on in your brain. We have a limited number of different things we can have floating around in our brain. So not having 3 + 4 be one of them frees up your working memory to function on, you know, focus on what you're actually trying to do.
It's a question of what do you want to be good at.
Right.
And
yeah.
Where's your priority?
In this case, I don't think it's even so upset. It's just that. And probably if you use a calculator a lot too, you might end up with the same sort of thing which I do. I do a lot of, most of my art tends to be digital art. It has been for a long time. I've recently gone back to drawing, and I'll draw a line I don't like, and my hand is already going for B and Z. And I'm like, where the hell did that? It's like, I can't undo this. But it just, my hand will twitch for it, because I'm so used to doing that. And so.
Yeah, I've heard of that. Also, another thing is, I read a recent article that Microsoft programmers are very bad at math, they found. And so now they're having everybody take math tests, making sure they can do basic math, because you spend all this time doing this high-level stuff, forget how to do the basic stuff.
Well, I don't want to get off on a big tangent, but I think there's a lot to be said for the correlation between people who are good at math and people who make good computer programs. It's not necessary to
be
good at math,
but not high level math, basic math.
Right, right.
Addition, multiplication.
Right, I see what you're saying.
Right.
But yeah.
I'd like to see what happens if we ask all of us to solve a long division problem by hand.
I could totally do it.
Really?
I think it's really useful to be able to do big basic calculations.
I have to triple check myself.
And there's there was a thing that you said about a useful function of a calculator that I think draws on a really different part of how machines work. You talked about finding irrational, I think it was about pi?
Right.
Yeah, but it was getting all of the numbers, essentially.
Right.
There's a function of that has nothing to do with computing or processing functions that's pure instrumentation, where you're taking a signal from the world and you're capturing it in machine form and then you're processing it. And
pi is a lookup table in calculator. It's not actually generated on a calculator. It's just somebody else did the work and converted that in to how many digits.
But I mean, if you wanted to know, you know, how deep is the water here or here or here or here, and you had a machine which could do that for you, it's fundamentally different than, you know, okay, I've got this high and this wide, and I want to figure out the area.
Right.
Getting a machine to it's getting a machine to take your input and convert it to the output, signal processing versus signal capturing.
Right.
You just
don't trust the irrational number?
It's that I don't think it hurts your ability to reason at all to have enhanced signal capture. And I think it's something that doesn't necessarily need to be grouped in with the detriments to signal processing that having machines which will process everything for you.
Well, there was this guy made mechanical analog computers. It was like a ball that rolled and it solved equations.
I'm doing a very horrible job of agreeing with you.
Of agreeing?
Well,
but it really happened.
You do one without the other, though. That's the problem. The problem is I could do high-level calculus without knowing arithmetic.
Nothing wrong with that.
There is nothing. Well, some people think there is something.
But that's abstraction.
Well, who are they and why do they think that?
Okay.
We will pummel them.
Some people make that argument, and I don't know why. And I can kind of empathize with that argument, is that, you know, arithmetic's more useful in your daily life, but you can't solve the problems that I can solve, right? So it's like, well, it has more a definition of good and bad.
I feel like we're caught
maybe
in a little bit of an eddy here, going back and forth on the same concept that we may not agree on.
Yes. Let's actually kind of wrap things up. We're at an hour and a half for this meeting, and that's awesome, but I still want to talk kind of after we close down this section about what possible future topics and how people are feeling about how things are going and stuff like that. So, any closing comments?
I got one. I went to the very first Transhumanist meetings for Seattle back when it first started, and it's become way better. There's like 3 people, and there wasn't very much conversation. It just died out quickly, but it's good to see that there's lots of people.
Hooray.
I used to be an officer, but then they removed me because I spoke bad about the book they were writing, so.
I'm sorry.
It's no problem.
Anyone else? Happy with it? Awesome.
How did we get started?
What did you say?
How did we get started on our topics? I like to go back and think about
conclusion.
The process,
no,
but I don't.
First of all,
how did we get started on the whole thing?
Well, what was our starting topic?
Didn't we have to agree
how
on
we relate
basic,
to machines and how we're relating to each other through machines?
Oh, that's a bad thing.
Yeah, I'm not very good at titling things. I have these ideas, but I'm crap at writing. I'm really good at talking to people, supposedly. But
I'd be interested in exploring maybe in a future meeting more about how we relate to each other through machines, because I read that title and then I ended up hanging out with a couple of different groups of people, and I don't play video games ever, but they both had these bits.
Yeah.
I've played with one before, and it was like our interaction centered around the one bit, and it was like, I want to explore that more and about how our interactions.
Okay.
Huh?